This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is President Frank Yamada from a seminary in Chicago. Welcome, Frank.
Good morning, Steve.
We're talking to you by phone, and I'm delighted to have you on the show here. I do want to say I think you may be the very first president of any seminary in the United States, maybe in the world, who grew up as a California surfer dude.
Do you think? I can't confirm that claim, Steve, but there aren't too many of us who lead these institutions who also surf.
And you are the first Asian-American president of Elise McCormick's Theological Seminary in Chicago. What do you know about that that particular history and that distinction? Are you also the first Asian-American president of any Protestant seminary in the U.S.?
I'm actually the second Asian-American president to serve as a president or dean to lead an institution of these types. I am the first Asian-American president to serve as in this role for a Presbyterian Church USA seminary, and because of that as well, I'm also the first to serve at McCormick Theological Seminary. My predecessor, Cynthia Campbell, was the first female president to serve as a PCUSA president. So McCormick has had this history of firsts in the last two presidencies.
And, of course, you have other distinctions as well. I was interested in reading your biography when you were announced as president 2 years ago, and I guess you've just finished your, what, second anniversary?
Just finished my second year, correct.
I remember reading when you first were chosen some of the things about your background, that you were a convert to Christianity. Your parents were nominally Buddhists, although not, I guess, actively practicing, as I've read about what you've said about that.
Correct. I converted to Protestant Christianity when I was 19, and as I like to say, my family, we were twice a year Buddhists, which meant that we went to temple about two times a year, usually when someone either passed away or when someone got married, which usually ended up to be about twice a year.
Uh-huh.
But we were not practicing Buddhists in the religious sense.
Now, when you converted to Christianity, you were baptized as an adult, which is unusual for many mainline Protestant folks. Rather than being baptized as an infant, you were baptized when you were 19 in the Pacific Ocean.
I was. It was just in Orange County, in a little place called Crystal Cove, and I was dunked in the Pacific Ocean, full body immersion baptism, because that was the tradition of that particular church, and it was shortly after I had converted when I was 19.
Tell us a little bit about your life before that. You're a third generation Japanese American. What does that mean?
Well, the term for Japanese Americans is sansei. It's simply san is the letter three, so it's the third generation. I'm a third generation Japanese American who grew up on the West Coast, which means that in my family's history, especially on my father's side, we have in our background the history it's a much more better known history now, but it wasn't when I was growing up, about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And though my father's family in particular wasn't part of that relocation, it is certainly part of our story, and it's certainly part of the story of my of Japanese American peoples on the West Coast. And so that's definitely part of my identity. And in fact, I live now here in the Midwest, and that's the story of many of Midwestern Japanese Americans as well, because many of them migrated to Chicago after World War II. But that was, interestingly enough, it wasn't part of much of our story growing up until sometime in the 80s when Ronald Reagan declared this as a great misstep from the U.S. government, and asked for an apology from the Japanese, apologized on behalf of the U.S. government to the Japanese American people.
Now, you say this was not a part of your own family history. How did your parents or grandparents escape that?
Well, my father's family, along with my great uncle, who was kind of leading this, was able to negotiate with a farmer in Utah to be able to live there during the course of the war, which they did, which had its benefits because they did have their freedom to move around. But it also meant that they were more exposed to the war hysteria that had kind of gripped this whole country, and they didn't have defenses to protect them. Now, the fences, of course, were prison camps for others, but so there were both opportunities and challenges that presented themselves in that situation for these families. But they lived in Utah until after the war, and after the war was over, shortly after, they moved back to California, where they were primarily farmers.
Let me push just a little bit on that that incident about being welcomed by a family in Utah. Were they Christian? Were they Mormon? Were they Buddhist?
My recollection is that it was a Mormon farmer, but I am not absolutely positive about that.
Okay.
Most of the stories that my aunts and uncles tell are the stories of their childhood, and they tell it from the perspective of when that they were that age. I can't give with complete accuracy the details of that.
Let's talk a little bit generally about that whole issue with your family history of some of your ancestors being at least under the threat of internment, of prison, really, just because of the wartime hysteria against the Japanese after the attack on Pearl Harbor. How does that help you as a biblical scholar, as a theologian, as a seminary president, deal with present hysteria in this country about people who are Muslims?
That's a great question, Steve. And let me first answer that before I talk a little bit about what that means for my current vocation. I had an experience. It was in my first or second year as a seminary professor. I was at Northwestern University, and they had an Asian American conference to address the internment, and it happened somewhere around the date February 19. Of course, February 19 is the date on which President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which allowed for the internment of all these Japanese Americans during World War II.
130,000 or even 200,000.
Yeah, it was close to 200,000, correct. And at this particular conference, one of the most moving panels for me was this panel of actual folks who had been through the internment camps. And it was just after 9/11 that this was happening. So just after 2001, 9/11/2001, and what was very moving for me, that there was these Japanese Americans who were across the political spectrum, Republican, Democrat, who were on this panel, and after hearing what had happened to many South Asians, many Middle Easterners who were Muslims, the outrage from this panel of Japanese Americans was just clear and unequivocal. They repeated many times, this cannot happen again. It was a very moving experience for me, because what it said to me is that though this hasn't been characteristic of the Japanese American community, there's a strong tradition of both equity and social justice for people whose rights have been limited. And that's part of the Japanese American story. It's part of the Asian American story, and that always provides rich historical resource for me as a biblical scholar. Of course, the Bible having many, many stories of the liberation of the people of Israel. Of course, the early Christians lived under Roman Empire rule, so the early Christians and the Israelites were no strangers social dislocation and governments acting strangely and hostily toward them. So it's a great resource for biblical scholarship, and from my perspective as well as the seminary president, it's a great historical resource for me to draw from as we think of larger inequities in current U.S. society, both to the current Muslim population and the Islamophobia that is rampant in this country, but also to some of the racial inequities that we've experienced recently in our country, for example, the responses to the recent incidents in the George Zimmerman case and the killing of Trayvon Martin.
I want to talk more about those kind of issues, but let me reintroduce our guest for folks who may have tuned in a little bit late to Keeping the Faith on this Sunday evening. We are recording this program earlier for the in order to be able to talk with our guest today, and so we're not accepting calls. Ordinarily, this is a live call-in show, but today, because of needing to record this earlier, we're doing it without calls. It's being broadcast on August 4th, 2013, and I say that because this show, like all other Keeping the Faith programs and other locally produced shows here on WILL AM 580 AM and FM HD3, all of our locally produced shows, of course, are available at your convenience. So you can listen to this show in the future if you can't hear all of it as it's being broadcast today on the 4th of August. And for many years, we know people will be listening to these shows. And so let me just again say that this is being broadcast. It'll be broadcast live on the Sunday, August 4th, 2013. And coming up next week here on Keeping the Faith will be a very, very important show. Not that this one isn't, but we're just delighted to have next week on August 11 a live interview by phone with the artist Carrie Newcomer, singer, songwriter, a wonderful performer, and very much committed to some of the important cross-cultural values, religious values that this show has tried to highlight over the last 14 years. So as we get down to the last several shows, we only have three to go after this one, before this program comes to an end after 14 years on August 25th. We've been very excited to have these last four guests with President Frank Yamada today from McCormick Theological Seminary and Carrie Newcomer on August 11. And Jane Kutz will be our guest August 18, talking about a recent book she's translated into English, Islam and the Challenge of Civilization. And that's should be a fascinating show. We're not exactly sure what will happen on August 25th. I may be interviewed reflecting back on the last 700 shows or so. We'll see what happens on that last day, August 25. But it's been a good run, and I'm happy today to be talking with Frank Yamada. Frank Yamada is a biblical professor. His specialty is the Hebrew Bible. And we'll be talking about that in just a moment. But he has, over the last 2 years, been one of the youngest seminary presidents in the country and the very first Asian American president for his denomination, which is Presbyterian. Frank, let's talk a little bit about how you became Presbyterian. How'd you make a choice after you became Christian?
Well, the short version of that story, Steve, is that, as I said, I converted to Christianity when I was 19 from a nominally Buddhist family. My first experience in the church was with a non-denominational charismatic megachurch, so an evangelical non-denominational megachurch. It was quite an extraordinary experience, though I must admit as well, having been raised in 19 years in a liberal arts environment, it didn't quite feed my mind in the same way that it fed my soul. It was a very contemporary musical environment, and I loved that, but it just, for my intellectual curiosities that didn't necessarily satisfy me. And that's when I ended up going to Princeton Theological Seminary, which is, of course, a Presbyterian USA seminary and is one of our oldest seminaries in the country. And went there because I really wanted to swim in a deeper stream. I really wanted to learn from a tradition that had had in its existence, decades and centuries of experience and theologians that contributed to it. And the Presbyterian Church USA, being one of the Reformed traditions, definitely had that. And it was for me a very transformative experience, both to be in higher education at this very prestigious seminary, but then also to learn of these traditions that stemmed way back to the Reformation and before. And for me, it was like growing roots deeper. And that was really kind of my first experience with the Presbyterian Church USA, and was shortly thereafter that I joined a Peace USA congregation.
Now, when you went to seminary, you were already married. You already had, just one child or two?
We had one child at the time, who was two, and then we had our second child when I was actually doing my doctoral work. I had stayed on after my master's to do doctoral work at Princeton Seminary, and our second child was born at Princeton.
And was there a gap between your college years and seminary?
There was a gap of maybe a few years where I worked in. I worked actually in retail for a while, and then I was also volunteering at a church startup. It was a church plant congregation that had a very similar DNA with a little more intellectual curiosity to the mega church that I belonged to. And it was a church of about 120, and volunteered there for many years. Also shaped my identity quite strongly.
Where did you meet your wife?
At the college where I was attending, where I did my, which is now Vanguard University, where I did my BA in religion.
When you went to seminary, I guess you were exploring whether to go or your first visit there. You reported one of the articles I read that you wrote in Christian Century magazine that when you came back, your father, who, as I guess you described, was not overly emotional, expressing emotion, brought your little son who was a toddler to the airport, even though it was late at night, to welcome you back. Tell us about that incident.
It was a very moving moment for me. It's one of those stories and memories for me that reminds me of though generations. This is in some ways a universal story. How generations of parents and children somehow don't find ways to connect. And my father and I were involved in that very same kind of story. We did have a significant connection when I came back from seminary. Of course, seminary would not have been his choice for my vocation. He wanted me to become a doctor or a lawyer or something like that.
Be careful of stereotypes.
What's that? I'm sorry.
I say, be careful of stereotypes.
yeah, that's right. Well, but it's very true. That's what he wanted for my life. So becoming a minister or a religious scholar was not high on his priority list. But when I returned from my visit, from my prospective student visit from Princeton Seminary, my father, this is, of course, pre-9/11, my father was actually standing there at the gate with my youngest son, and my youngest son, who was then just under two, just ran to me. As I was coming up the jetway, and I gave him a big hug. And as I was hugging him, I looked at my father, and he had this knowing smile. Though my father, a very typical Nisei second-generation Japanese-American, didn't show much emotion and never expressed much with his words in terms of his affection for his children. I could see in that knowing glance, that knowing smile, what he was communicating, and that was that he loved me just in the same way that I loved my child. And it was one of those wonderful moments where I finally understood his care and his dedication and his love for me.
As president of a seminary, a major Protestant seminary, it's you describe the seminary, I don't know whether you chose these words or it came from a committee there at the seminary, but you talk about it first as being an urban seminary. Why is that important?
Well, McCormick Theological Seminary, which was originally founded in Hanover, Indiana, and then moved to Chicago, Illinois, right from its start was intended to be an urban seminary. It was located for many years on the north side of Chicago in what is now a fairly affluent part at Lincoln Park. But when you attended seminary there, Steve, I'm assuming it wasn't such a affluent place. But it's had as part of its DNA, very similar to Union Theological Seminary in New York, this urban identity. And since then, we have moved to the south side of Chicago in Hyde Park. Chicago has made a lot of news recently because of the gun violence that has been rampant in our communities here. Our seminary is located in the middle of these communities. Now, Hyde Park is also near the University of Chicago, so it has this interesting mixture of both academic kind of elite and excellence, but it also has these economically challenged neighborhoods. And how that's really shaped McCormick's identity is that a majority of our students, not a majority, but a significant percentage of our students, serve churches that are from these communities. Though we are a Presbyterian Church USA seminary, I would say only about 35% of our students are Presbyterian.
I noticed on your statement of purpose, you say McCormick Theological Seminary encourages, embraces, celebrates, and prepares women and men from all denominations and backgrounds for Christian ministry and service.
Correct.
That's a broad group of folks.
But it is. One of the things that we tell folks about our seminary is that we do not have a racial ethnic majority among our student population. We do not have a denominational majority among our student population. Our next largest population of students is denominationally our Baptist. And then I think after that it's non-denominational or evangelical groups or Pentecostals. And many of these are also African-American churches. So it really is, our diversity really does reflect the diversity that's in the city of Chicago. So that's one of the reasons why we are both a cross-cultural seminary and an urban seminary.
But my question, I guess, that arises as someone who graduated from that seminary now, let's see, how many years would it be, 1969, a very long time ago. At the time, it was seen as probably the most liberal or most progressive theologically, not politically necessarily, although maybe that too, of all the Presbyterian seminaries and maybe most seminaries at the time in the late 60s. Now, is that still the case, or has this broadening, which comes about, this diversity, which comes about because of liberal principles being acted out, does that make the place much more conservative now?
I wouldn't say that it makes the seminary more conservative. I like to describe to folks, when I'm describing McCormick, I like to describe for folks that we are so liberal that we have fundamentalist Christians that study right alongside of us. That's how open we are to, and how much we take seriously the idea of dialogue, and not just dialogue, that this diversity is the key to what makes our educational model work. We not only have some of the most radically progressive and liberal Presbyterians and other denominations studying among here, because McCormick has had that reputation, but we have students from the Apostolic Assembly, students from the Black Baptist traditions that traditionally have really been fundamentalist denominations. But in the process of our relationship with these congregations, Their leadership has often been trained here, and they encourage their leaders to continue to be trained in McCormick, and it creates this rich environment where both liberals, far left-leaning liberals, and far right-leaning conservatives sit in classes together and discuss things like Bible and discuss things like what we Presbyterians call sacraments. It's not across the board in denominations that they believe in them to be sacraments. But to have a conversation about baptism between Presbyterians and Lutherans and Episcopalians and Baptists, it really is an amazing thing that happens when you hear students realize, and you can see it on their faces when they begin to understand that their traditions aren't the only traditions in the Christian family. And it's really a key to the way that we deliver our theological educational model.
Let me introduce again our guest, Frank Yamada. Dr. Yamada is a professor of biblical studies, specializing in the Hebrew Bible, what Christians traditionally have called the Old Testament, perhaps too dismissively. Frank is a scholar, author of several books, recently was commissioned to write a commentary on the book of Joshua. What series is that with, Frank?
It is a series that is going to be put out by Liturgical Press, which is a Roman Catholic press, and it is called Wisdom, and the Wisdom Bible Commentary Series, which will be a feminist commentary series.
Is this unusual for the Roman Catholic Church?
It is. It is not unusual for Roman Catholic scholarly circles. And I wouldn't say that it's unusual. For Roman Catholic traditions, it may be unusual for folks who attend a traditional Roman Catholic parish. But as you know, Steve, Roman Catholics have often been some of the key progressive leaders when it comes to things like liberation theology, and many of our first feminist theologians were Roman Catholic women. So it aligns itself with that tradition of Roman Catholic scholarship.
And some people listening, since this program is heard in Illinois and Indiana, some people listening may not know that the Catholic biblical scholarship was sort of set free well within your scholarly lifetime, Frank.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which pope was it? I forget.
It probably happened sometime after Vatican II, I would assume. So it's probably, I'm thinking it might be John Paul II.
Right. So this Wisdom Commentary Series, you were selected to write the book of Joshua. Was that your choice, or did they approach you about that?
They approached me.
Now, that's one of the toughest books in the whole Bible to write commentary on.
And from a feminist perspective, especially, because, again, part of the feminist tradition is an anti-violence tradition as well, and healing for the whole human family. And the book of Joshua hasn't been known to be a book that champions that cause.
Well, for those who don't know anything about the Hebrew Bible or the book of Joshua, this is the book where the Israelite people believed that they were commanded by God to go in and destroy Canaanite cities, wiping out whole populations, genocide, really. And it's recorded as a good thing. How are you going to approach that?
Well, I think, again, in good feminist hermeneutical traditions, and when I mean hermeneutics, interpretive theory traditions, feminist scholarship, feminist interpretive strategies have included often what they call a hermeneutics of suspicion, which basically, the basic idea behind it is that you don't take a text at face value, that often you have to work critically with a text to best understand it, and that a text will try and communicate something, and it often is communicating other things that it doesn't intend. And I think the book of Joshua is a perfect example of that. It, of course, is a text that justifies Israel's presence in the land of Canaan, And it does have these very strong holy war themes that to the modern sensibilities sound excessively violent and very difficult to deal with ethically. But there also are some wonderful stories, and one of the trademarks of this particular commentary series as well is that it includes the opportunity to listen to other voices beyond the scholar's own voice, so you are encouraged to actually include other perspectives that are different than your own, especially other women's perspectives that are different than your own. And one of the things that I've learned in doing my research on the Book of Joshua is that there are traditions of feminist readers who read characters like the character Rahab the prostitute and how instrumental she is, though she's a Canaanite, how instrumental she is in advancing the causes of this group of Israelites, and how important she is to the full story.
And she's welcomed into Israel in the end.
She is, correct, correct. Now, and there's also some wonderful traditions in African American circles about the transitions in leadership from Moses to Joshua. And this is something huge, not just within African American traditions, but in Asian American traditions as well, because generations are a big part of Asian American ethos, a big part of the Asian American story. But in particular, I think one of the reasons why it's signaled by so many African American authors is the African American church. It was going through and is still currently going through a significant shift in its leadership structures. To younger generations of leaders. And for those reasons, Joshua's had a lot of traction within this community because that's the way the Book of Joshua begins, with this transition of leadership from Moses, the prophet and leader in Israel par excellence, to this new upstart Joshua. So I think it has some things to say to this transition of leadership that we experience in some of our communities of color.
Frank Yamada, president of McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, is also one of the editors of the People's Bible, which takes the New Revised Standard Version with the Apocrypha and provides very helpful, interesting introductory essays, suggestions on how people from many different cultures can approach the Bible. And I noticed in several of the parts that you wrote, of some of the essays you wrote in the People's Bible, when you were describing yourself, you said that because of your Asian American identity, that you're often drawn to conflicts and contradictions in the biblical text, seeing them not as a problem to be fixed, but as difficult and sometimes painful openings into another people's understanding of the world and of God. So you're clearly quite conscious of how you're approaching these biblical texts from your own cultural and historical and family ancestral perspectives.
Correct. And to unpack that just a little bit, our society, our current society, is kind of stuck in some ways when we look at our political environment. It just feels like we think that you have to be conservative or liberal. You have to be progressive or conservative. These kind of polarities that exist in our society, and you have to kind of be either or. One ways that has been kind of characteristic of both Asian American and Asian traditions is to think kind of, it's not necessarily both and, but it's to keep things together in a tension, and in a tension that you don't necessarily resolve. And I find that extraordinarily helpful for my own life and my own witness within the Christian tradition, but also for understanding things like the Bible. I mean, the Bible is kind of a book of books. It's not a single book with one perspective. It's a Bible. It's a book that contains many different perspectives, and sometimes just leaves them there with their contradictions and their tensions and difficulties side by side. I think that that's actually a model for communities of faith. Rather than always assuming that you need to win the day, sometimes to be in community, it means that you have to exist with tensions that are often difficult and feel uncomfortable.
Well, before we leave the book of Joshua, I just can't resist asking a mean question.
Okay.
And I do this partly because, you know, I've been host of this show because of the graciousness of Illinois Public Radio for these 14 years, and they've never told me who I could talk to, or they've never told me what I could say or didn't say. And I've tried to, you know, interview a whole breadth of a lot of different people, a lot of different perspectives, but I know I have my biases, I have my prejudices. And, you know, one of them is, you know, I talked to scientists. My spouse is a scientist. And I can remember talking to a scientist the first place where I was a campus minister at North Carolina State University before I came to the University of Illinois. His name was Ellis Kolling. He was a brilliant researcher and was studying acid rain long before there was very much concern, at least the level of concern about the environment we have now. And I was a young campus pastor, and he said, "Now, about this book of Joshua," he said, "you know, I'm a good believer. I'm a person of faith. I believe in God. I'm a Christian. I'm even a Presbyterian like you, Steve." But he said, "Joshua, what do we do with that story about the sun standing still so that the Israelites could triumph in a battle with daylight and wipe out more Canaanites?" He said, "It's the science." He said, "Then they just thought, oh, yeah, the sun stands still, the moon stands still. But we know now the earth is spinning. That's what makes the sun." What kind of coefficient of friction would it take when we put it into the formula, see when God just stopped the earth from spinning and all the things on the planet, how far would they slide?
It would be disastrous from a scientific point of view. Isn't that correct?
There you go. So what are you going to do about that when you get to that part of Joshua?
Well, you know, and these kind of debates exist today, and science, the kind of intersection of science and theology, science and the Bible, it's a really interesting set of questions. It's a really interesting kind of niche of scholarship right now. All this to say, you know, Steve, you and I, and all of us, we're products of the Enlightenment, and fundamentalism is definitely a byproduct of the Enlightenment as well. And it was really the fundamentalists who began to ask these questions of trying to make science, our current understandings of science, in some ways mesh with what they understood to be biblical literal truth. And so this is where we get this creationism. This is where we get, you know, a 7-day creation, which
anti-evolutionism, yeah,
exactly. Right. Which we know from a scientific point of view is absolutely ludicrous. Okay, so it has no basis in fact. But what I find interesting as a student of history is this impulse that we've inherited in North America to try and make these things come together. And in some ways, I think that's what's going on when you're asking the question of how in the world does the Earth stand still? We are looking at it from a scientific point of view and saying this is scientifically impossible, which it is. And if it were to happen, all these other things, these disasters would have taken place. And on the fundamentalist side, what you get are these people who are trying to rationalize, well, this is theoretically how it could happen. I think, to be honest, this is the wrong question to ask of the biblical text. It really is not the questions that are driving the meaningful truth that for the people for whom the Bible was written. The idea of the gods being able to enact upon the cosmos is not a new idea. It's an ancient idea. And their understandings of how the cosmos worked were very different than ours. In short, what they were trying to say in Joshua is that God did a miracle for us. Now, that's something that even the modern sensibilities can understand. In short, what I'm trying to say is that the text really needs to be read mythologically, not in the sense that of how we understand myth as not being true, but it's asking for truth in a different through a different lens, and the truth that Israel's trying to proclaim through that incident is that indeed this is God's battle, not ours. To the point where God can do extraordinary things to turn the tide of victory in their direction.
I was in preparing for this interview, looking at an earlier commentary on Joshua written by my professor, Bob Bowling, along with G. Ernest Wright, a major name in the history of biblical scholarship, of course.
And also a McCormick professor at one.
That's
point.
True.
Yes.
And before Harvard, and Ernest Wright and Bob Bowling at this point in their translation point out that this particular passage, part of it is in poetry and part of it says, is it not recorded in the book of Yashar? So here's this story apparently from a literary source already before it gets recorded in what we call our Bible, our scripture. And form makes such a difference in trying to understand what's going on in the Bible. And when a third of it is poetry, a third of the Hebrew Bible is poetry, many scholars say, that changes partially how we think about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And think about it. And by the way, this question was raised for me before I became a biblical scholar when I was my mentor in this evangelical church plant, a very, very bright guy, and his name is Adam Ayers. By the way, our youngest son is his namesake. His name is Adam. Very influential guy in my life. His question was, you know, he had us read some poetry, some Shakespeare, to ask a question, did this literally happen, is the wrong question to ask of a piece of poetry. It speaks truth in a very different tongue and in a very different style and in a very different way. And when we look at biblical poetry, that it's your professors were right. Sorry about the pun about there, but when Wright and Bowling are making the case that biblical poetry deserves to be read in a certain kind of way, then the genre makes a difference. They're absolutely correct.
Now, I notice you read widely. I saw in one of your commentaries for preachers, not commentaries, one of your articles for preachers, that you started off quoting from Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It, and you ended with a quote from Langston Hughes, a poem about rivers. You were talking about baptism. How do you find time as a biblical scholar and a seminary president to also read poetry and fiction?
How I find time is it's a mystery to me, but I make time. And it's part of that comes from my fascination with not just literature, but literature in its truest sense is a form of what we call today popular culture. For many, that was the popular culture of the day. And I think literature and popular culture are these great resources that help us to make meaning of the world. And so I love to put these resources in conversation with things like the Bible to help people kind of understand and to illuminate the biblical text in a different kind of way. My connection, by the way, to Norman MacLean wasn't because I just read his short stories right from the start. It was because I was very, very captivated by Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It, which was an adaptation of one of MacLean's short stories. And it sent me back to the short story to read it. And that's often, how it works. These things are all connected because we're inspired by a piece of literature, we're inspired by a movie, and it helps us to understand the world. And because of that, I think they're great resources for understanding biblical truth as well. Now, how we find time to do that is a difficulty, but in some ways they're always in front of us, whether it's we're sitting down and we're paying way too much for a movie on a Saturday evening, or whether we're watching the television set. There are literary tropes and references everywhere if we just look for them.
I've heard you speak about another book you read recently called That Used to Be Us by Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum, that's come out in a new edition in paperback recently, where they talk about the needs in America to adapt to globalization and information technology and cope with the budget deficits nationally and internationally, and the problems with all the effects of contemporary culture on the environment. You also find time, obviously, to read in political and economic theory.
Yeah, and
why is that important for you as a biblical scholar?
Well, I would say it's a little less important for me as a biblical scholar. It's important for me as a theological scholar or a theologian, because I think the things that they describe are things that also affect higher education in general, and therefore affect theological education specifically. I mean, they really name like four challenges, and I think these challenges are pertinent to anyone who is interested in higher education, and issues of globalization, the influence of information technology or IT, and how we make this work in a completely changed economic environment is something that everyone in higher education is talking about. And so it's one of the reasons why I picked up the book. And by the way, Steve, you were asking me how I have time. one of the little breakthroughs that I had recently, I have a long commute. It's usually about an hour to an hour and 15 minutes every day that I commute from the north side of Chicago where I live to the south side of Chicago where I work.
So you're still in Evanston?
I am still in Evanston. And one of the breakthroughs for me was to listen to Audible books. And in fact, I did not read Friedman and Mandelbaum in a paperback or hardbook hardcover form. I listened to them on Audible books, and then I went back and looked at the book later to kind of look at points that I found very interesting.
Frank, I need to interrupt you quickly. Sure. Do you ever listen to the radio?
I do listen to the radio, and I do listen to NPR often.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, so that was actually one of my breakthroughs, that I could spend significant chunks of my morning while I was sitting in traffic listening to books that I think speak very relevantly to our current context, whether they're books by economists or books on business theory or books on entrepreneurship or books on leadership or books on how we fix the things that are broke in today's society.
One of the things you're trying to fix is seminary education. What do you think's wrong with it?
Seminary education is dealing with some of the things that we're facing in all of higher education, and those things include costs that are too high for students, which affect our students in particular ways, because most of our students aren't going to go out and make a lot of money. Most of them are going to be either serving at a non-for-profit or are going to be clergy. And as you know, those salaries aren't always in the highest ranges. So the costs of education are a big concern that are facing everyone in higher education. The other issue is the degree to which the degree itself actually helps to produce the kind of training and skills necessary for the profession to which that person will be heading. So the relevance of this degree for the vocation that the student is seeking, all of these things are long and old questions in higher education but they've become particularly pronounced in recent years, especially after 2008 and the economic collapse, really, of our country.
We're recording this program in the middle of July to be broadcast on August 4th, 2013. It's being heard on WILL AM 580 and also on FM 90.9 HD3 over the air, courtesy of Illinois Public Media. It's also available as an archive in the weeks ahead and can be heard at will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. Frank Yamada is our guest. I want to thank him for being taking an hour out of his life to be on the program today. And we have about, 8 minutes to go. But just want to take a minute to let listeners know that they cannot call in today. This is a pre-recorded program in order to be able to fit into President Yamada's schedule. Frank Yamada is president of McCormick Theological Seminary, a seminary of the Presbyterian Church USA. And it happens to be my alma mater. I have prepared a few mean questions for Frank, so this isn't just a puff piece between an old grad and a current young president. Let me ask one of those mean questions again, Frank, a different one. I asked one about the Book of Joshua. Let me ask one about fundraising for seminaries. You've just mentioned that the graduates you have are not like law school graduates or med school graduates or business school graduates or even engineering graduates or from universities. You have an odd situation where your graduates, you know, are not going to have much money to give to the seminary. How does a seminary survive financially given that?
Well, first of all, and this isn't true of McCormick at this point, I'm thankful that we're not we're not asking those kinds of questions at this point. But it is an open question among seminaries and institutions of theological education: is what is the financial viability long term for a lot of our schools? And the prospects actually do not look all that promising. It has a lot to do with what you just named. You know, many university and college presidents, when they do their fundraising, they can raise a lot of money because their alums are CEOs, they're lawyers, they're doctors, and people are very grateful for their experiences in college, and so they're willing to give back to their alma maters. Now, I think one of the benefits that we do have in seminary education is, though our alums don't make a lot of money, and though alumni support is an important piece of what we do when we're raising money, because we do, it's important for all donors to understand that the institution is supported by its alums. But one of the things that we do benefit from, and this has been done through research at places like the School of Philanthropy at IUPUI, at Indiana University and Purdue University, they have documented quite well that two of the highest sectors in philanthropic giving are in higher education and in religion. What's nice for the seminary world is that's our sweet spot. I mean, we really are talking about a school of higher education that's devoted towards religious education and the formation of religious leaders. So I think that is one of the larger giving trends that speaks well to our future. And my sense, Steve, too, is that the importance of religion, though it's very clear that our current churches are struggling with membership, that religious participation in general is declining in North America, that religion's not going away. And in fact, if we look globally, religion is only becoming more important. So to be able to have well-trained, good thinking religious leaders is going to be something that our society is going to continue to need. And because of that, I think that that philanthropic giving to things like seminary still has a chance. At least there's some optimism given the fact that there's still a significant case to be made for theological education in the future.
In our last 2 minutes, Frank Yamada, McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, what do you offer students who come to your school?
First of all, we offer them a top-rate education with some of the best scholars in the country in an environment, as I said, where they can experience a racial, ethnic, and denominational diversity that they will not be able to experience in their own faith communities. And this provides for them an opportunity both to learn in an atmosphere of diversity, but also to sharpen their own sense of who they are in their own faith perspective. And that educational experience, from my point of view, is really second to none for those who graduate from McCormick. But we are also able to provide many of our students financial assistance because of that, and that's something that we continue to do. It's something that we will continue to do even more in the future to lessen the debt load of our students so that they can prepare for their context of ministry and for their to be religious leaders of the future, because we're going to need them. But if they're going to be strapped with so much debt that it makes them have to leave the religious sphere to be able to work to pay down their debt, then we're really training them for nothing. We can provide that, and we continue to provide that for our leaders here in Chicago and beyond for the 21st century.
I'd like to thank Frank Yamada for being on our program today. Appreciate your taking time to talk with us by phone.
Steve, it's been my pleasure, and thank you very much.
Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we have a very special program with the guest Carrie Newcomer, singer and songwriter known around the world. We're very fortunate that she's willing to talk with us by phone live on August 11. On August 18, our next to last Keeping the Faith program, ending our 14-year series here on the WILL AM 580, Jane Kuntz will be our guest, a translator of a fascinating new book on Islam and the Challenge of Civilization by Abdelwahab Medeb. I'm sure she'll tell me how to pronounce that name correctly. And then our last show, August 25, will be something special. We're working on that, and hope you enjoy that last Keeping the Faith show. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host here on Keeping the Faith, and I'm happy to give thanks to some of the other people who filled in here on Keeping the Faith. Don Nolan, who has probably been a guest host most often, also Stan Yanchus, and for a few times, someone from the University YMCA, which has been a longtime supporter of Keeping the Faith here at the University of Illinois campus, Becca Guyette. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Thanks for making AM 580 a part of your weekend. I'm Jason Croft, and this is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana, and streaming online at will.illinois.edu. This American Life with Ira Glass is straight ahead. Today, a show titled Show Me the Way, stories about people in trouble who look for help in mystifying places. Then at 7, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. In the first hour, the 51%. In the second hour, the creative brain. Stay tuned.